Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing services to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus, as I said before in the news, we'll be talking with a researcher who's done a lot of work, generally speaking, in the area of fish conservation, but of course more broadly in trying to understand the health of aquatic ecosystems and what it is that sometimes we do either to make them healthy or to put them at risk, looking at a lot of different areas, including government policy, the pressures that commercial fishing can put on fish stocks, the kinds of pressures that sport fishing can put on the fish stocks. And our guest for the program in this first hour is David Philip. He is principal scientist in the Center for Aquatic Ecology and Conservation at the Illinois Natural History Survey, which is based here on the campus of the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. In addition, he is an adjunct professor in the departments of animal biology and natural resources and environmental sciences here at the U of I. He serves on the board of directors of the Fisheries Conservation Foundation and also on the Independent Scientific Advisory Board for the Fish and Wildlife Management folks who are concerned about the Columbia River, those issues right there. His very specific interest is in one fish in particular, and that is the black bass, and has co-authored a book which probably tells you everything you ever wanted to know about the black bass, which is entitled Black Bass Ecology, Conservation, and Management. It is a kind of a book that, you know, perhaps might appeal just to specialists, but if that's the kind of thing that interests you, you can go and take a look at it. And people who are listening this morning have questions. I know that he will do his best to give you an answer. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And also we have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about something I feel rather passionately about.
Sure. Well, to start, let's talk on a very general level. What sort of issues concern you?
Okay. Well, I'd say that you could categorize issues associated with fisheries conservation into four different types, and we often refer to those as the four H's: habitat, harvest, the hydrosystems, and hatcheries. Some of these, like hatcheries, are maybe more important in freshwater than marine systems, but others, like habitat loss, are pretty important everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's really just in the last little bit of time that we're truly getting an understanding of how all these different issues interact to determine the future of fish populations. And in fact, I believe that in the past, certainly, and really to a great extent today, many fisheries management agencies have made a fundamental mistake in how they have chosen their management strategies, because they've taken really an agricultural approach rather than an approach set in an evolutionary context. So, for example, on the farm, we target single species. We control their environment, that is, we control the food they get, we control their habitat very closely, we even control their reproduction. We eliminate competitors. We eliminate predators. Hmm. And in fact, in many circumstances, we line breed for specific characteristics that we desire for those animals to possess on the farm. But our fish populations live in the wild, not on the farm. And as such, the individuals are members of naturally reproducing populations that exist within communities of a whole lot of different other species, different organisms. There is competition, there is predation, both upon them and by them, etc. And so individuals in these different species interact with each other and with their environment in very complex ways as part of a very complex ecosystem, not as a monoculture on a farm. These aren't row crops, they aren't Holsteins, these are wild fish populations. And so the bottom line is fish populations evolve in response to natural selection, no matter how badly we'd wish them to do otherwise. Yeah. That's what they do. So many fisheries management agencies, I think, have failed to grasp this, and so they haven't had a real good track record over the past several decades. Although, happily for Illinois, the Illinois DNR's Division of Fisheries is really an exception to this and has had a very enlightened approach. They've worked with us and other researchers for many, many decades and so have had quite a good success rate.
So are we talking about primarily agencies that are managing the resource as a commercial resource or for sport fishing or both?
Both. Certainly, most inland states have predominantly recreational fisheries interests, although Great Lakes states and the coastal states have much bigger commercial fisheries as well.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, we have a caller here, so and we can get into these issues in a little bit more depth, but rather than make this person wait,
sure.
Why don't we go ahead and see what their question is and bring them into the conversation. I'm not sure if I gave the phone number. I'll do that. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call if you have questions. Here's caller in Urbana, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking about farming prompts me to ask, what has been the result of farming? What has been the result on distant waters from farming, logging, other economic activities? At first glance, would be thousands and thousands of miles away from a water water environment, and that at first would seem to be unconnected, but if you study, finally does have a distant connection.
Most does definitely.
Makes sense.
Oh, yes. Oh, I understand the question well.
And listen, because it's a very broad area, and I just wanted to know what your take was on it.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
The effect is not good. Both logging and row crop and livestock farming certainly has negative impacts on watersheds, the streams through siltation, which certainly hinders the reproduction of fish and all sorts of other aquatic organisms. But also it transports toxic chemicals downstream so that, for example, there from much of the agriculture that's done throughout the middle part of the U.S., there is a lot of toxic chemicals that have gone all the way through down through the Mississippi River, and now there is an anoxic and kind of a dead zone in the off the coast of the Mississippi Delta that extends for many, many miles, in which essentially all living organisms are predominantly have been extirpated. So that is a serious concern and one that's being dealt with by all of the states in the Mississippi River. It's called non-point source pollution, and that is clearly a big problem. Logging, of course, not only has it increased siltation, but it's also reduced the shade effect, and so the riparian zone once it's been harvested and sun now enters the equation, it has raised the temperature of headland streams in a variety of locations, and that has made them incapable of supporting reproduction. It's particularly bad out in the west, where the headwater streams are the site for reproduction of many of the salmonids, that is the trout and the salmon, which need cool water, and the temperatures reach extremes that are too high for fish. And so, yes, logging and farming can have catastrophic effects on aquatic communities.
Hmm. Certainly, I know that there is some controversy, but that a lot of scientists do really believe that agricultural runoff, and not just from agriculture, but it also can be from the stuff that people put on their lawns and would be put on golf courses and all of that, has definitely had ended up going into the Mississippi and then helping to create this problem that we have in the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. But it's also true that some of the country's biggest metropolitan areas are located on the coasts, and that we do have significant problems on the coastal areas, and that's maybe not doesn't have so much to do with agriculture, although there are some places I think there are large animal confinement operations that do play a role. But if you're looking at places like New York City, for example, or other places along the East Coast, we also have a significant problem there with coastal waters because we have these large concentrations of people and waste of one kind and another that's produced by these large groups of people. also ends up in the water.
Oh,
and,
exactly.
And that's a problem, too.
Oh, sure. I don't. Agriculture is not the only culprit. Yeah. Most of the culprits could be brought back to our single species, however. But, you know, and so certainly high densities of humans create a problem as well. And that's goes all up and down the Mississippi River as well. There's all sorts of runoffs and industrial waste and all sorts of things. It's not just agriculture.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else. This is a caller in Belgium over by Danville. Line 4. Hello.
Good morning, sir.
Mm-hmm.
First question that comes to mind is invasive species to me. The most recent of which is the Asian snakehead carp. Do I have the name quite right on that?
Not quite. There are Asian carp and then there are snakeheads. They're both from Asia. Some are carps and some are snakeheads, and they're both exotic, yes.
And then, of course, there were in the Great Lakes, there was an eel that caused a great deal of problem years ago. I don't know how it's been resolved. But it seems that these species really have no way of stopping them. Now, we may have introduced them with our activities, or maybe they've just shown up on their own. I'm not knowledgeable enough to speak on that. But how do we solve this problem? Or do we solve this problem?
We're trying to solve this problem. It takes regulations, and it is a huge issue, and they have come in for a variety of ways. The eel you referred to is probably the sea lamprey, which came up from the Atlantic Ocean years and years ago when the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Welland Canal were constructed. So what we did through transportation construction, et cetera, was open a natural waterway so that they could come in. They are still a huge problem. We're dealing with them by having a massive campaign where we poison the small larvae in various streams that serve as broodstock to keep that numbers down, those numbers down. We will probably never eradicate them from the Great Lakes. The snakehead is a fish that came in through the pet aquarium trade and releases from individuals, mostly out east. And that is just a burgeoning problem right now. It's just blossoming out there because there has been a few that have been released and have naturally reproduced, but the extent of which is not really well known. The Asian carp is a different story. That was brought in intentionally by aquaculturists to produce either food or for, in the case of like black carp, to control mollusks in other commercial aquaculture ventures.
All of which are going to just continue to be more and more of a problem in our estuaries and waterways and lakes and et cetera, right?
Oh, yes, very much so. And there's a huge controversy right now over the state of Maryland that wants to bring in an Asian oyster to reintroduce into the Chesapeake Bay because the habitat and water quality in the Chesapeake Bay has proven to not be sustainable for keeping the native oysters going. And it was a huge commercial fishery for native oysters, and they just can't get them reestablished. So the idea from the governor of Maryland was to bring in an Asian oyster and see if that would do better because it supposedly does better under more adverse conditions. Of course, his neighbors around the Chesapeake Bay are adamantly opposed to it. And that is one of the problems that shows one of the problems that we do have in that decisions to bring in non-native species is really a state-by-state decision, and there is really no federal legislation that can kind of control this. So, in fact, one state can do what they want, and usually one fish chief can do what he or she wants.
Now that you've opened that topic, the Chesapeake Bay is probably a very, very interesting topic for probably a whole hour show, in that it's had so many problems. I mean, there used to be a blue crab was a very, very valuable species there, which has been decimated a great deal in the oyster population there. And also when you were talking earlier about the farm activities, the eastern shore of Maryland has a lot of chicken farms and pig farms that have caused a great deal of problems with not only mankind, but with the habitat also. It's a whole microcosm of exactly what your problems you've been talking about.
Oh, yes, most definitely. And the fisheries have been in danger and have collapsed and sort of rebounded with moratoria on takes and harvest, et cetera. But some of the fisheries, like the blue crab and the oyster, are on the verge of total extirpation.
And also the pollution that came from the industrialization in Baltimore and Philadelphia and places like that has definitely caused problems in the same sort of area too. So they have a real severe problem in a beautiful bay that was used by people and animals both.
Oh yes, and it's not an uncommon problem in bays around the world. One of the bad situations is, even though we know what the problem was and we can correct an awful lot of the point source pollution, its heritage lasts for a long time and can create long-lasting toxic issues once we've in the sediment and slow release, etc. It's not an easy process to just turn right around and get pristine, clear water again.
Yeah, it is very amazing, too, since Washington, D.C. is essentially located on the bay. It's on Potomac, obviously.
Oh, yes.
It enters into the bay. But they're so close to the problem, but yet they seem to look right over it. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Certainly.
Other questions are welcome. Our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is David Philip. He is principal scientist in the Center for Aquatic Ecology and Conservation at the Illinois Natural History Survey here at the U of I. He's also adjunct professor in the departments of animal biology and natural resources and environmental sciences. And we're talking about fish conservation. If you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, going back to the topic that you just touched on closer to the beginning about your feeling that we have a problem here with fishery management agencies who approach these complex ecosystems that are natural, where the species are wild, where we have a number of them, where they all interact. And apparently what they have done is targeted particular species that they're interested in. And I suppose it could – bass might be one of them. Salmon might be one of them. Mm-hmm. One of those sorts of things where they said, well, we know that people are interested in this. It could be for commercial fishing. Could be sport fishing. So we want to make sure that we have plenty of these fish for people. And so we've concentrated on that. So why is that a problem?
Well, okay. Let me give you an example with black bass,
yeah,
because,
okay,
A, that's the species that I deal with, do most of my research, and can call a spade, essentially, on. most people are familiar – when I mention black bass, it's a group of species. Most people are familiar with the most common two species, which are largemouth bass and smallmouth bass, but there are actually 9 different species. Largemouth bass is probably the most sought-after and popular sport fish in all of North America. Certainly – numbers of anglers that target it, and definitely the amount of money that's spent on angling for black bass exceeds all others. Historically, black bass, the historic range, say 100 years ago, was predominantly the eastern half of the United States, some up into Canada, some down into Mexico. But since the turn of the last century, states out further west that did not have black bass imported them. And in fact, countries all over the world have imported them. Maybe up to 120 different countries have imported black bass, mostly largemouth bass. And in most cases, they have been a real problem because they eat many of the native fishes and have extirpated whole complexes in a variety of places. And many of the local biologists now are trying to get rid of them, and that's not an easy process. but let me give you one example. In California, just around the turn of the 20th century, they introduced largemouth bass, the California Department of Fish and Game. And to do this, what they did is they train-loaded a group of bass, actually from the state of Illinois, out to Southern California. 8 survived. They put those in a pond. They did reproduce. We don't know how many actually reproduced. It could have been 1 male and 1 female. We don't even know how many were males and females. But presumably some of those 8 reproduced. And those offspring were then raised and used as broodstock for the entire state for the next 50 to 60 years. So it conceivably the entire state of California could have been seeded from originally brothers and sisters matings. Anyway, they established a variety of populations that were not particularly well grow. You know, they didn't grow very well. They didn't reach very large sizes. They weren't a very fit population for fisheries. And so back in the early 60s, one of the biologists suggested that, in fact, they bring in a different bass, one from Florida, because the rationale was that bass in Florida grew so much bigger than they did in Illinois that fish from there would hopefully get bigger. And in reality, if you were to look at the environments of California and Florida, they would certainly be closer together than California and Illinois. So that might have made sense originally if someone felt the need to introduce largemouth bass. But they were brought in and intermingled with the fish that were already there. And lo and behold, about 8 or 10 years later, all of a sudden there were some really large fish coming out, so a few really trophy-sized fish, which attracted a lot of attention nationwide. And it was proclaimed that this was due to the Florida bass docking, that these were Florida bass coming out. Well, in reality, that was probably not the case. They probably weren't pure Florida bass to begin with, and they hybridized with the fish that were already there, which were inbred, and now we produced what was what we call a F1 or first-generation hybrid. And if you look at what we do in corn plants, oftentimes those hybrids have tremendous hybrid vigor, but their fitness actually is quite low. You never plant the kernels from a hybrid corn. Anyway, those trophy bass attracted an awful lot of attention, and states all over the country didn't want to be outdone by California, so they started importing Florida bass and stocking them on top of native populations of the largemouth bass that were already there. Originally, these fish were described as a different subspecies. We've recently done some pretty high-end molecular work and clearly show that these are two quite different species. So what has happened is that all of the states basically south of the Mason-Dixon line from Maryland through Oklahoma have stocked huge numbers of this species, Florida bass, on top of the native largemouth bass. And many, if not the majority of the native populations throughout the probably the southern half of the range of this most important species, has been compromised by the introduction of these fish. Hmm. Now, it's those stocking programs have done a lot for bass fishing because it's been a lot of hype, and there are trophy fish that are coming out. Records have been broken. It's all been given the credit for the stocking program. But when you look back, in fact, lots of things have changed since 1970. We have electronic fish finders. We have all sorts of new fishing gear. And when you look at the records on these states that have stocked Florida bass, in fact, yes, 70%+ of them did break state records. But when you look at the states that did not stock Florida bass, 70%+ of them broke state records too. So the fact that these large fish are due to the stocking is not entirely clear at all. And so what we did is there was a lot of pressure brought on the Illinois Department of Conservation back then, the Division of Fisheries, to stock Florida bass, as was every state all the way up to Minnesota trying to be pressured by anglers to stock those. So we entered into a research program instead of going willy-nilly ahead in Illinois and did some research on this. And it was in collaboration with Texas and Florida and Minnesota. So we took fish from each of these, raised them in Illinois, stocked them out. They were genetically tagged. We followed their success and, in fact, showed that in each case, it was the native stock of fish that survived the best, grew the fastest, and reproduce the best. So, in fact, bringing fish from Florida to Illinois had a negative result. In reality, they all hybridized, and the resulting populations were, in fact, had half the fitness of the native population. So by introducing these fish, not only did you decrease the growth rate, you decreased the survival, you decreased the reproductive success, and you ended up with a population that now wasn't the same and could not be recovered because it would have been irreparably compromised genetically. Hmm. And that's also occurred in Texas and et cetera. So that was a little bit hard for a lot of the states to swallow, and they still find lots of ways to why not to believe that. However, we have gone into – I've been collaborating with Dr. Tony Goldberg over in the Vet College to look at the mechanisms of this outbreeding depression, the loss of fitness with these groups hybridize. And what we've shown is that the hybridized fish are exposed to disease agents like a largemouth bass virus that we've been working on, their susceptibility is hugely increased compared to the native stocks that weren't hybridized. So that what it appears is that in this mixing of genomes across fish populations, it's a good reason for this, what we see as the outbreeding depression, is their loss of ability to fight off diseases. And that has huge ramifications because now these fish have been moved around all over the place, and so native populations can really be suffering from this kind of insidious and hidden loss of fitness.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. But of course, among other things, one of the big bottom lines, obviously, people, I would think, even if you're not a geneticist, would take away, is the basic idea is that when you jumble up genetics, you never know what you're going to get.
You never know. And the chance of coming out a winner is pretty darn slim.
And so, has that kind of story been repeated with other species of fish? I mean, can you maybe find examples where they have tried to do the same sort of thing with some other fish and with a similar kind of result? Or maybe the thing is maybe not a similar result, but an unintended result.
Certainly, the story of mixing stocks has occurred in trout populations as well. And for example, rainbow trout were introduced into the Yellowstone River, which had native cutthroat trout population, and now they've hybridized with the native cutthroat trout to produce this rainbow cutthroat hybrid, which has very different properties than the native cutthroat trout. There's a huge amount of effort throughout the West to resurrect native stocks of trout. Realize too that there have been outbreaks of new diseases like whirling disease, and how this history of mixed stocking has impacted the ability of populations that once were resistant to whirling disease now to have outbreaks is unclear, but there's a good chance for a parallel to our largemouth bass virus study, where the outbreeding depression that we see is due to a mixing up of the, say, major histocompatibility index, or the complex, so these gene complexes that design antibody response, et cetera.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. I have several callers. We'll get them into the conversation here in just a moment, but I do want, again, to introduce our guest, in case you might have just tuned in the last few minutes. David Phillip is principal scientist in the Center for Aquatic Ecology and Conservation at the Illinois Natural History Survey, which is based here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's also adjunct professor in the departments of Animal Biology and Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. He serves on the board of directors of the Fisheries Conservation Foundation and also serves on the Independent Scientific Advisory Board for the Fish and Wildlife Management of the Columbia River. And his particular, very specific area of interest and research is the black bass, and is the co-editor of a book titled Black Bass Ecology, Conservation, and Management, published by the American Fisheries Society. Questions are certainly welcome, and we have some people here ready to go. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have some Champaign folks here ready and waiting in line one. We'll go there first. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wanted to make two comments about fish. I love to catch them and eat them. I'm 69 years old. I'm a nurse by profession. But my question is, I catch native trout and bass. How do we make the native fish? How do we start? I know that stocking is not the way to go. How do we make the native fish more prevalent? And I haven't read your book. I want to. But if you want me to stay on, I will. And if you don't, I'll hang up.
Well, you're welcome to stay on.
Yes.
Well, I think it's an excellent question, obviously, because we've been talking here about how it's not the way to do it. But as the caller would say, and I'm sure a lot of people would understand that in a lot of places, their fish stocks are a great resource. They want to protect, maintain, grow them if they can, because people will come there and they will fish and they will spend their money. What's a better way to do it than what we have talked about in the examples that you've given?
I think the first thing we have to do is to get rid of what I call the great myth. And that is what anglers have been fed and now believe, and that is, many of them, that the reason there are fish out there that we fish for is because man put them there. And even in pretty remote places, I do a lot of research up in Canada, and there is a lake that we do extensive behavioral work on. And there was an angler out fishing on top of some of our bass spawning areas before the season started illegally, and we had a discussion, and he was joking that in fact that we should spend a lot less money on this research and a lot more money just on increasing the number of bass that were stocked into the lake. I informed him and said, yeah, actually, there had never been bass stocked into that lake, and I doubt there ever would be because there was a huge, healthy population there. And he just couldn't believe it. He goes, well, how could they – where did these bass come from? I said, well, they came when the glaciers receded, you know, several thousand years ago and have been here ever since, and these fish were born here, like most fishes, all of the fishes in this lake. And that was just too difficult for him to believe, that he was just under the assumption that fish that are that anglers fish for are put in the lakes, grown there, put in the lakes by fishery management agencies, mm-hmm. produced in hatcheries, grown in the lakes, and that's what we do with them. Well, that's just not the case. And so one of the things we do have to realize is that most of the fish in the United States were born right there. Now, there are a number of fisheries that are constructed solely from hatchery fish. For example, many lakes now can't sustain walleye populations. They are grown in hatcheries, put in, and basically a put, grow, and take fishery, which is, to be honest, a pretty expensive operation. But, you know, it's not, and I don't want to bash hatcheries totally by saying that they're all not good. They do form a purpose. There are environments that are incapable right now of sustaining populations. We can run them through a hatchery and produce fish that go back out from those native environments and kind of help these populations limp along until hopefully we've solved the habitat problems or whatever is the process. What it really comes down to is that we have to realize that for a given species, all of the populations in that species aren't the same. Some are evolved, like for largemouth bass, some are evolved to make it through the cold winters up in northern Minnesota, others through the hot winters down in Alabama, hot summers in Alabama. Fish then have adapted different life history trajectories, different ways of doing that, and so they have evolved for those environments. When we start moving them around, treating a bass from anywhere as an equal, then we've got problems. And so we have to realize that populations or species are actually mosaics of individually divergent populations, and we have to stop mixing those stocks across the boundaries. So that's where we get outbreeding depression. For example, the fish from Florida going to Minnesota died under the ice because they hadn't put enough weight on, so they didn't have fats to make it through winter. They didn't die because it got so cold. They died because they ran out of gas under the ice because they weren't evolved to do that. On the other hand, fish from Minnesota down in Florida awaited the winter by they loaded on fat, didn't grow, and the Florida fish grew all throughout that winter and then ate the smaller Minnesota fish that had made the wrong life history choice. So we need to stop mixing fish and help by having more regulations designed to conserve the populations rather than to try to maximize fishing opportunities necessarily.
I have one other question. Some people do not like fish to eat them. Fish make them sick. I think they're very healthy myself. Do you have any suggestions I know that they are. Do you have any suggestions? Maybe your book addresses this question.
The book probably doesn't. It's really a compendium of pretty hard science research. But, you know, certainly all fish are probably, in my mind, taste good. I go fishing a lot and I eat fish a lot. Now, some individuals, just with their genetic makeup, don't do well with fish because they're probably allergic to certain parts. I know I have a good friend that's very allergic to fish, and so he can't even come close to them without breaking out into hives and losing some respiratory functions. I don't know that we can help them with that situation. Other fishes, of course, are difficult to deal with because they come from areas where they can accumulate toxins. And so there's always a need to look for local warnings or whatever that is to make sure that you're not eating too much of a good thing and therefore overdosing with various toxins that you don't want to be ingesting.
Yeah. Well, I thank the caller for her questions and comments. We have some others. Let's go to our next caller, also in Champaign, line number 2 right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
One of my unsung heroes in this equation is the Indian Fish and Wildlife Service in upper Wisconsin, Michigan, and the upper part of the state. due to some of the remarks that you've made about the transferring and the fish and that, would you make some comment on the Indian Fish and Wildlife Service and what they have to do with this big problem we're having in our country? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, I'm not actually sure what the Indian Fish and Wildlife Service is, but there are tribal biologists and there are tribal jurisdictions, and they interact with the federal U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the state agencies in various ways determined by treaty law, et cetera, and it's on a state-by-state, tribe-by-tribe basis. They are certainly strong components or proponents of various conservation measures. They oftentimes are also strong proponents of hatcheries because of mitigation efforts. For example, out in the Columbia River, where salmon are so depleted these days, there are 137 different hatcheries that are producing salmon for a variety of reasons, many of which are specifically done in mitigation for construction of the various big hydroelectric dams that are out there. Many of them are constructed on tribal lands and for the purpose for tribal harvest, etc. The tribes are very strong proponents for habitat restoration for a variety of what I consider very positive attributes to move fisheries management in the right direction. They may not necessarily take the evolutionary approach that I would like to when it comes down to hatchery production, et cetera, because I think it clearly there's quite a debate going on out in the Pacific Northwest right now on the relationship between hatchery fish and wild fish. And are hatcheries the answer? You know, and after 50 years of 100-plus hatcheries and we're still have seriously depleted populations, they can't be the end-all answer at all. And in fact, I think a mismanaged hatchery can be as detrimental as no hatchery at all, more so, actually. So I think the bottom line is the conservation record for tribes is very good in many instances and not all that perfect in other instances.
Okay. Well, let's talk with someone in Charleston. This caller is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I'm looking at this conversation through a social lens, and humans seem to have no ultimate predator. We are the ultimate predator, and everything we do is unchecked. Our social organization permits a sort of survivalist paradigm, and I guess my question is since we are organized in the manner we are, can we do enough soon enough? Because at 6 billion people, I don't think fish or all sorts of food, including fish. I've heard about the Japanese net fishers who take everything, sweep the ocean, and grind that all up and turn it into food. And as the human population grows and our source of food diminishes, what are we going to do?
Oh, isn't it so frustrating?
Yes.
Yes. That brings up lots of issues. You know, there are fish are really the last set of wild organisms that we harvest commercially for food value in any large extent. And we haven't learned how to do that sustainably. We go from one fishery to the next. We fish down. Certainly the big commercial fisheries in the oceans have been a litany of disasters where we fish a species down to unfishable levels. Then we move on to the next and keep going through this cycle. And that is a huge problem. And I think the caller brought up an interesting sight of big commercial fishing taking these huge nets and taking everything. And I think if if the public, the general public, knew how some of or many of the fish were actually harvested with trawlers that go along the bottom and essentially scrape a half-mile wide swath along the bottom, taking everything in existence, including all of the coral, all of the structure, and totally destroying it until it regenerates in 5, 10, 20 years. Okay? If they saw how we harvested those fish, they wouldn't order them in restaurants. If they saw the waste of longline fishery that takes less than 20% of the fish that are killed to go to market, the rest being bycatch that they cannot legally harvest, and they throw that overboard, that bycatch being marine mammals, turtles like loggerheads, endangered turtles, seabirds, etc., they wouldn't eat those fish as well. I mean, so one of the problems is that the public doesn't know really what's going on in commercial fishing. It's in a lot of the aquatic habitat. The problem is it's a hidden crisis because it's below the surface of the water. When everything is nice and clear and you can't see it, it must all be okay. But many of these populations are seriously in trouble, and we just don't see it because we don't look there, and B, if we did, we couldn't see below the surface. So, and there's a huge problem with that. And as fishery scientists, many of us have been very frustrated with the inability of decision makers to take the relevant data and use it for the right to make the right decisions, or any decisions, actually. They make decisions based on interesting data sources, not any of which are oftentimes the right ones. In response to that, as David mentioned, I'm on the board of directors for the Fisheries Conservation Foundation. That's an offshoot of the American Fisheries Society, which is our professional society. And it is an offshoot that has become necessary due to our frustration. We are not able to get the message of fisheries conservation, fisheries needs to not only decision makers, but to the general public. And so this foundation is basically an effort by scientists to partner with the private sector to use private funding to help deliver the message to the public. And interestingly, for fisheries conservation, historically, the anglers, the private anglers, have really shouldered the bulk of the expense for conservation, aquatic conservation, through licenses and through excise taxes that they pay on fishing equipment, boat usage, all that. It's a huge thing that generates tens, if not hundreds of million dollars a year that is paid for directly by anglers and usage fees. Many of the wealthy investment bankers or corporate owners are avid anglers, and they are frustrated as well by not seeing the resource go in the right direction. They are willing to commit personal funds, and we're trying to harness that opportunity, their willingness to back this horse and to work closely with them, partner private money with scientists that want to get this message out to the public, because until that happens, things won't change.
Yeah. People, I think, more and more in recent years, we've heard about the problem of overfishing and the kind of scenario that you outlined with very heavy commercial fishing exhausting one particular stock and then saying, well, we fished all those and let's go and fish for something else. And we've heard about the collapse of the cod fishery is mm-hmm. one of the examples, and there are others. Is that a problem more for national waters where nations are saying, okay, these waters are ours and we're going to decide what we're going to do with them, and anybody else wants to tell us what to do, you know, you can sail off someplace else? Or is it more of a problem in international waters where theoretically it's a common resource and that there is supposed to be some kind of international body determining how that resource is used and protected?
Oh, definitely the international waters suffer from the tragedy mm-hmm. of the commons, much more so than single or dual jurisdiction. We have great relationships with Canada, so we have lots of treaties. But it gets touchy, like Pacific salmon on their harvest back to their natal rivers to spawn, which is when they're harvested and mostly out in the ocean and as they enter estuaries. They make a big circle down, you know, past Alaska. So Alaskan fishermen get their shot first, then down through BC and Vancouver, and then to Washington, Oregon, and California, and they get their fisheries. They get their option or shot at those fish last. And so there's quite a treaty network to make sure each gets a representative sample. But out in the middle of the ocean, out off the St. George's Banks, et cetera, where huge multinational corporations can fish these fish down to almost extirpation, they're going to do, you know, the impetus not to do it by saying, well, we think that's a bad situation, only allows another country and another company to come in and do it anyway. That's the tragedy. And clearly the problem comes in because the basic belief is, well, we can fish it down, then we'll come back in 20 years and it will have rebounded and we'll fish it again, like cutting trees or et cetera. Well, in reality, it's a complex ecosystem. When you take that top predator away, other fish move in. Other fish fill that niche, and the cod will not rebound like they and will not return to the population that they had that was there 100 years ago. In fact, now there are new species in there at unprecedented levels to compete with them. So this whole community, the whole ecosystem has changed forever.
We have some other callers. Let's talk with someone in Stell, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Oh, this is such a heavy issue that you've just been discussing. It just seems like we lack the political will to interfere with the almighty capital gain there. But my question had to do with, in your opinion, Professor, is there an issue with the fish populations with the wide distribution now of genetically engineered row crops, which are going to affect everything eventually, I believe, from what I understand? I mean, they will infiltrate into the environment. There wouldn't be a direct connection unless you're talking about farmed fish, which are fed row crops.
Well, in reality, we don't have to worry as much about the row crops because the fish themselves have been genetically modified. There are Atlantic salmon that have specific antifreeze genes engineered into them. They have alternative growth hormone genes introduced into them, et cetera, to try to develop a domesticated stock for aquaculture to get them in much better, much faster condition. So there are already genetically modified fish that have been produced from a variety of different species. Their regulation has been pretty tight so far. However, there are fish that are capable of escaping into the wild that are genetically modified.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what we know of from Canada and the U.S. There are a lot of Asian countries that we may not know what actually is happening. And the latest tsunami, not only did it destroy a lot of the coastal villages, et cetera, and all of their native fisheries, it destroyed lots of aquaculture establishments across the whole Indian Ocean. Those fish are now have been released all over everywhere.
Oh, yes. Well, thank you for your insight.
All right. Thanks for the call. And there, just the bottom line there is we really don't know whether that potentially is a problem or not, or will be a problem.
Well, we don't know. The ecological response, if genes, alternative genes and alternative growth hormones and growth patterns and life histories that have been manufactured escape into the wild and are introduced into these fishes, what that ramification will have for those populations is unknown. I mean, a fish that grows at a much higher rate, requiring a much higher food intake, how that would do in the wild is unclear. My expectation is it would create terribly unfit populations because the food base isn't there to support that level of growth.
Well, and again, that goes back to that example that you gave near the beginning of the program of the bass that from Florida that they thought, well, these bass are really big. That's great. We want big fish because fishermen like to catch big fish. And they took them and they put them in other places. And as you said, there was a number of unforeseen consequences. We ended up with something actually was different from what you started out with. It had an impact on the native species that were there and that you never – The lesson I took away from it was when you do something like that, you never really know what's going to happen. So here we've got an uncontrolled experiment going on.
Mm-hmm.
If that indeed happens, you really don't know what happens if these fish that have been engineered to have these characteristics and have these gene lines go out and get out into the environment and start to inbreed with the wild fish. Just don't know.
Exactly.
Don't know what you're going to get.
And even, it goes not only beyond that. Here's another great example that will drive some of the listeners wild, that there was a huge interest in starting salmon culture and salmon cage culture on the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. The ultimate decision by the BC government through their Norwegian advisors was not to use Pacific salmon, but to bring in Atlantic salmon. And so Atlantic salmon have been cage cultured all up and down the Pacific Northwest. Of course, everybody was promised that there would be no downsides to this. Fish wouldn't get loose because it would be not profitable, no diseases. Well, the bottom line is a million fish have gotten loose. They've been established at a number of rivers. There are diseases now in Pacific salmon that have never been outside of the Atlantic salmon. So, it's the same story time and time again, where some person gave, hoodwinked people for their own economic gain.
Yeah. Well, there is so much more we could talk about, but we've used our time. Okay. We'll have to stop for right now. Maybe on another day we'll talk some more.
Certainly. Thank you very much.
Well, appreciate your coming by. Our guest, David Philip, he is principal scientist in the Center for Aquatic Ecology and Conservation at the Illinois Natural History Survey here at the U of I, where he is also adjunct professor in the departments of animal biology and natural resources and environmental sciences. This hour of Focus, made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. The program also made possible today by a grant from Horeen's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horeen's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Coming up a little bit later today as part of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll look into the history of the National Geographic magazine. It began as a technical journal late in the 19th century. Its readership numbered just about 1,000. Today it has millions of readers and it reaches people via radio, television, and the internet. Celeste Quinn today will be talking with journalist Robert Poole, author of the book Explorer's House, National Geographic and the World It Made. That's part of the Afternoon Magazine at noon here. It gets underway at noon with the usual mix of news and weather and sports and other things, and then the interview comes along in the 1 o'clock hour of the program. Coming up in the next hour of this show, we will be talking about Alexander the Great. Certainly, recently, there has been a lot of interest in Alexander. We've had a big movie, and apparently there will be another one, and a number of books have been written. We'll talk about why it is that the character of Alexander the Great continues to fascinate us, and we'll also talk about a decision that he made that ultimately was his downfall. Having conquered most of the world, he decided that it wasn't enough, and he looked east and embarked on a long and ultimately disastrous campaign across Asia. We'll be talking with John Priebus about his recent book, Envy of the Gods. That's in the next hour of the show. First, though, we'll take a break for news and update on the market, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets. We're seeing in the soybean pit, higher trend today on